Okay. Anything you say, we're going to be able to
can
prove.
And will be used against you. Okay, good. So we're live. Apropos starting Talmud study, I actually believe that the right way to start the study of Talmud is first to study Mishnah for a while, and only then to study Talmud. In my experience, I think it's gotten better, but my experience of learning to study Talmud was very Darwinian. You know, people started teaching me Talmud, and you either understood what was going on or you didn't. You know, people who were more attuned to Talmud's way of thinking and had better linguistic skills and were interested did well, and other people just sort of flew by. So my father tells a story, sort of sums up the pedagogy of a certain school, a certain traditional school of Talmud instruction. So my father grew up in Newark, and he went to public school till 7th grade. 8th grade, my grandfather decided that he should get some yeshiva training, and so he was packed off to Tiferes Yerushalayim, which was Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's yeshiva on the Lower East Side, and he was dorming there, as he likes to say, was a boarding school. And so he had never studied Talmud before at all. And he walks into the class the first day, and the Rebbe is saying, so somebody gives utensils or a cow to somebody to watch. And my father's like, what? You know, who's cow and what are we talking about and why are we talking about this? But, you know, you looked around and everybody's going like this. So, you know, you go with the flow. So he walked into this situation where he had been totally unprepared for what he was going to be studying, why he was going to be studying it, what the rules were, and he just had to kind of pick it up as he went along. That's exactly the way, obviously, not to introduce people to Talmud, but it happens. Okay, so Rabbi Wexler told me that you had reached the last thing that you had discussed was the very bottom of 6B, Baba Mutei, Amarav Halacha to Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. So now let's go back and recall in what context Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha made a statement and what the statement was. Right? So the discussion in the last section of the Talmud is whether or not it is desirable to encourage litigants to engage in some kind of compromise. And there is one view, Rabbi Eliezer, Benosha Rabbi Yossi, who says, right, Asur Livtsoa, it's forbidden to solve a case this way. There are others who say that it is permitted, and Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha says it is a mitzvah, right? It's a mitzvah to do this. And Rabbi Shimon ben Manasseh adds that you can only do this until such time as it's not clear to you which way the case ought to be decided. Once it's clear to you which way the case ought to be decided, you can no longer encourage the litigants to, in effect, split the difference. And I assume you discussed the whys and wherefores of it. I mean, you know, one way, you know, part of what's going on here, obviously, is the commitment to the truth on the one hand, and the commitment to, you know, harmony and the smooth functioning of society on the other hand. If you are very committed to the truth element, so as Rabbi Eliezer said, Yikov Hadin Etahar, right? Let the law carve its way through the mountain. Let nothing stand in the way of law. We always are searching for the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And others say, truth is not so important in these cases. And of course, this is a special case. Or the cases that we're talking about here are special in that we are talking about arrangements between people. And when we're talking about arrangements between people, it is easier to say that if the two parties are willing to accept compromise X, then there is no reason that the law has to come in and impose on them the obligation to go before the court and have the case, you know, heard till the end. There's nothing there's nothing wrong with simply settling the case in whatever way is satisfactory to both parties. So now the Talmud says that the halakha, or Rav said, the halakha is like Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha. Rav was a student of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, Rabbi Judah the Patriarch, the editor of the Mishnah. He studied in Eretz Yisrael and then went to Bavel, and there he was one of the first rabbis that we know of at the beginning of the rabbinic movement there. Okay, so after the Talmud says that the law is in accordance with Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha, so in the Schottenstein, which I understand is what you're using, that's the last paragraph on, well, these pages aren't numbered, are they?
63,
right, okay. So the Talmud says, is this so? In other words, is the law in accordance with Rabbi Yehoshua ben Korcha, which is that it is desirable, it is a mitzvah for a judge to become an arbitrator? But Rav Huna was a disciple of Rav. And yet, when litigants came before Rav Huna, he would say to them, if you want justice, I will provide it. If you want compromise, I will provide it. And he offered both alternatives. If, as Rav asserts, it is meritorious, a mitzvah, for a judge to arbitrate a compromise, why did his disciple, Rav Huna, leave it up to the litigants to decide whether they wanted to compromise? Mitzvah implies that one option is to be preferred to the other option. So he should have said, I really would prefer to arbitrate this case. If you refuse to do that, then we will go to law. I once had a case with a guy who was supposed to have rebuilt my engine. And after he supposedly rebuilt it, exactly what had happened that caused me to bring the car to him happened again. And there was a pre-trial meeting with the judge. And the judge heard the case, and this guy claimed that he rebuilt the engine. And I said, yes, but look, the same thing happened. And the judge said, well, on the one hand, there's no evidence that this person did not rebuild the engine. On the other hand, you had the same problem. So the judge said, I would be inclined to rule in favor of the party who would choose not to go forward with the case. In other words, what he was saying to us was, compromise, split the difference, and that's what we did.
Why would a judge care, whether he would give the law or to arbitrate? You know, here they do it because I don't want to take the time and expense, you know, of the judicial system. But why would this guy say, sorry, I forgot his name, I could do it, either way. Well, why would he care which way?
Any thoughts? Anybody else? What I would say is, first of all, I'm not sure that the fact that you mentioned wouldn't be applicable here, in terms of if you're actually having a court case. If, for example, it's a claim that I borrowed money from you, and you say I borrowed money from you, and I say no, I didn't, or you say I borrowed money but I didn't pay back, and I say, yes, I did pay back. Well, if it's a court case, then we're going to have to get witnesses and question the witnesses, and maybe there'll be other witnesses. Whereas if we arbitrate, we can say, well, there seems to be different recollections about what happened here, and so let's just split the difference. But the other thing I think is that the judges here, and I think the rabbinic leadership, has an interest in good relations within the community. You know, sometimes you can win a case, people win cases, and they lose friends, they stop talking to family members. You know, it's a Pyrrhic victory. And so, in a sense, you could say that asking people to compromise is to say, let's do this in a way that the financial issues will not trump the personal relationship, which often happens in court cases. Okay, so where are we here? Okay, so now the Gemara answers. What is the meritorious practice to which Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha refers? So the answer is, it is a meritorious deed for the judge to say, if you want the law, I think I stapled over it, I will provide it. If you want compromise, I will provide it. So the Talmud is redefining what Rabbi Yoshua ben Karcha meant when he said that is a mitzvah to compromise. That he did not mean it is a mitzvah to advocate compromise, but it is a mitzvah to mention that as a possibility, is to open the door to compromise where people might not have thought of that option otherwise. But the judge is under no obligation to push that particular way of solving the problem. Okay, I mean, this happens all the time in Talmud, and I'm sure you've encountered it numerous times, which is that the Talmud reinterprets a statement in a way that is, I would say, less plausible than how we originally understood the statement. And the Talmud does that in part. See, there's a kind of a paradox in how decisions are made in the Talmud. On the one hand, the post-Mishnaic rabbis understand themselves to be of lesser authority than the pre-Mishnaic rabbis. The Tanaim have more authority than the Amoraim. And therefore, many times in the Talmud, I'm sure you've encountered this too, an Amora will make a statement, and the Talmud would say, well, how could he make that statement? Because we have a Tanaitic source that disagrees with him. And then the solution will usually be, well, but there's a different Tanaitic source that agrees with the Samora, so therefore he's still okay in saying what he says. Or the Talmud reinterprets the Tanaitic statement. Now what that means is that even though in theory the Tanaitic rabbis are of greater authority than the Amoraim, in practice, what those rabbis meant when they said what they said is determined by the later rabbis. So in effect, it is the later rabbis who literally, but also figuratively, have the last word. That is, they will take a certain position which may indeed fly in the face of Tanaitic consensus, but will then say, well, nonetheless, what I'm saying is the view to be followed, because actually the Tanaim agree with me, and even though they seem not to, here is how I'm going to interpret what they say. Now, there's room to be cynical about that, and I think not without reason, but it's also important to understand that what this means is, and this happens often enough in life, when we're very convinced that something is true, we tend to interpret all evidence to the contrary in accordance with our very fundamental belief. I mean, imagine having a conversation about politics. Two people who are very firmly committed to two very different positions. It is rare that the result of that conversation is that one of the two parties says, you know, you're right, I don't know why I've been a Republican all my life. From now on I'm going to vote Democrat. That's not usually how the discussion ends. Why? Because the truth is, the conclusion is foreordained. You have two people who are very much committed to two points of view. And mainly what's going to happen in the discussion is that when you try to score a point against me, I'll either counterattack or I'll say no because blah, 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 and then I'll attack your view and you say no, blah, blah. Right? So that's really what goes on in many discussions between people who are firmly committed to particular points of view, which is that there isn't really much movement from either side. And this is what we see in the Talmud very often is a form of that. I'm committed to a certain point of view, and when there is evidence to the contrary, I say, in effect, as long as I can interpret that source in a way that it is possible that I am in accordance with that source, or that source is in accordance with me, even though it is not likely, or that is not the most likely reading of that source, I am entitled to read it that way and to maintain my view. Okay. So now the Talmud says, okay, fine. So this is Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha's statement that it's a mitzvah, which is that it is incumbent upon the judge to offer the possibility of arbitration as well as a trial. So the Talmud says, but wait a second, that is the same as the opinion of the Tanna Kamma, right? The anonymous first Tanna who is mentioned said that compromises also with three, and that once the law is, the case is decided, you can't go back and arbitrate it, but the implication is, although he didn't say it in so many words, of this first view is, you can judge a case, you can have a trial, or you can have compromise, because he mentions that as a possibility. So then Rabbi Shua ben Korcha is saying the same as the first Tana, which is that a compromise or arbitration is also a possibility. So the Talmud answers, the difference between them, the Gemara answers, the difference between them is the question of whether the offer of compromise is a meritorious deed. In other words, the first view is that, yes, in theory, either one is acceptable, but there's no obligation to mention both of these alternatives. Whereas, according to Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha, we raise people's consciousness. We want them to know that there is such an option. And usually, by the very fact of mentioning an option that people might not have thought of otherwise, you're indicating in some way that that might be a preferable solution. Okay. And then the Talmud spells it out. Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha maintains that the offer of compromise is a meritorious deed, whereas the Tanna Kamma, the first anonymous Tanna above, maintains that even the offer of compromise is only elective. Okay. Now the Talmud says, well, wait a second. But that, in other words, if we say now that the view of the first Tanna is that it's up to the parties to go to court if they wish, or to accept arbitration if they wish, and there's no reason to push one or the other, if that is what they mean, then that is the same as Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh's view. And as Schattenstein Artswell explains, according to this interpretation of the Tanna Kamma's view, even the offer of compromise is only elective. What then is the difference between the Tanna Kamma's view and that of Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh, who also holds that offering compromise is only elective? Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh said, when two come before you in judgment, and if you had not heard their case, or you have not, or you've heard the case, but you're not sure which way the law inclines, you can say to them, compromise if you wish. But once it's clear to you which way the law is going to go, then you are not allowed to say to them, compromise. So Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh seems to be saying, it's up to them. They can do what they want. But you don't have to push one possibility or the other. So the Gemara answers, the difference between their opinions involves the statement of Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh, when you, the judge, have heard the litigant's statements and know towards which side the judgment leans, you are not permitted to say to them, go out and compromise. Right? So Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh holds that a judge is permitted to offer compromise only until he knows whom the judgment favors. The Tanna Kamma, however, holds that offering compromise is permitted until the verdict is announced. So, I don't know if you discussed this, but what do you make of Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh's view, that once the judge sees that, based on the facts that he or she has heard, it seems pretty clear to him that A will have to pay B, or B will have to pay A, so why would Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh, do you think, say that at that point you really can't offer the possibility of arbitration?
I think because the community knows the truth, you cannot avoid judging according to the truth.
Okay. So, right. Now, here it's not really the community that knows it, right?
The
it's
judge, the judge.
Right. So, again, the judge has this dual obligation of the truth and, you know, shalom, creating harmony between the two litigants. But once I'm pretty sure which way the law will go, to suggest arbitration is going against the truth. But I think there's also something very practical here. Yeah.
I think it's he's partial to the one who knows which way it's going to go.
Okay, so he can't serve as an honest broker.
Right.
That's also true. There's also a third thing that's true, and that is that once I know which way the case should go, then I know that if I suggest arbitration, in effect, I'm causing you potentially to lose money that you are entitled to, according to the law. So I'm not allowed to do that. Right? If it's clear to me that if we go to court, you're going to get $100, but now when there's arbitration, you're only going to get $50. So by suggesting or engaging in arbitration, I am in effect causing you to lose money to which you are probably entitled. If I haven't heard all the facts yet, and I just know you say this and you say that, so I as a judge can say, well, you know what, let's stop there. If you disagree, I'm sure there's a lot of evidence on both sides. Let's not get into that. What do you think would be a reasonable solution? Let's discuss that. So that the judge may do as, because of this, that point doesn't have the knowledge that clashes with making a compromise.
If two people came to the judge and, as you said, they made a decision to compromise and they reach a compromise, down the road, a day later, a week later, a third party can come and say, this is not justice, we demand the real justice to the situation.
The third party?
The third party, a neighbor, come and say, this is not justice. Can he come to the judge and say, this is not...
How is the neighbor involved legally?
So let's say it's an issue of cruelty to animals, that somebody caused damage or didn't behave according to the community acceptance of issues. And there was a compromise reached between the two parties. But the third party can come and say, you know, I don't agree that that compromise is a compromise. I think that something should be dealt differently. Is the situation like this happened?
Okay, so in the case that you're discussing, at least the way you're conceptualizing the case, not all the affected parties have appeared before the judge.
That was a compromise between two.
Yeah, but if by being cruel to animals, I'm doing something for which everyone in the community can take me to court, then my neighbor cannot go to court with me and say, I, on behalf of the whole neighborhood, will reach the following compromise with you.
No, but my dog and the other guy was the bad guy, and we decided to compromise somehow. But then somebody else... So this is not an example.
Okay, but now we have a new court case. Okay, the court case between the original two parties is a question of money, right? Question of damages.
Money could
your
be
dog,
a solution to a problem, but it's not always money. That's
right.
The issue itself.
That's right. Your dog bites me. Okay, I sue you. We go for arbitration. The arbitration says that you pay me X amount of money. Now, if somebody comes to the court and says, but yes, in allowing his dog to bite people, he has violated some other statute, right? And in fact, that would come under one of the four main categories of torts that the Mishnah talks about in Bava Kamma. Shor, right, which is, stands for allowing my, being negligent in my...
Shor-muad.
Right. Negligent with my animal. So that's a new court case. That's a different now. That's a different charge. So,
Well, I think the difference though is hire the lawyer. So, I mean, a good example in a way is this case that the SEC
have the city about the city's mortgage, let's say it's, I don't even know what the details, whatever the mortgage problems are, and they resolved it.
Right.
And they went before the judge, and the judge said, this is a class action, the judge said, well, I have to approve or not, and one of the factors I have to take into account is the public interest. And I don't see, the public has an interest in knowing what the facts are here, and actually having, almost saying that the case should be decided, not settled, without the public being aware of, you know, what the facts are, because the public has a right to know. But you're,
let's just look at that case for a moment. So in that case, again, I would argue that if it's a class action suit, then not everyone who is affected by this case is there in court. Right? If we could get everybody into the courtroom, right, then we could poll all of those people and we could say, is this settlement acceptable to you? But that's not the case. So what happens there is that someone else is representing the interests of that group of people. So it's saying, in effect, that you may have settled with the lawyers who are representing this group of people, but you haven't necessarily taken into account all of what those people probably want and what they would have said to you before you settled the case. So that's a different situation. So it's,
I think the answer here is, you know, just because there may be public interests involved doesn't mean that they get resolved by a private resolution between the two parties.
So it's going to be a different case.
However the public interest gets addressed when one person does something, that's still presumably still available.
This case is referred to.
So yeah. I think it's something analogous to what Ron's pointing out. Maybe the rabbi, the judge, would have said, this isn't the case I'm going to offer you to arbitrate.
Yes,
this is
right.
Something that requires that be chosen.
I don't know if anybody saw this Iranian film, Separation, which just won the Academy. It's very interesting from many points of view, but in the film, this is a state that lives under Islamic law, which I'm going to say from a little bit I know, has a lot of similarities to the kinds of laws we've been studying. So there are two court cases in this film. One's a civil case, one's a criminal case. Civil case is a divorce. Two parties kind of separate. They have a fundamental disagreement about where they should live, and particularly where their daughter should live. Come to court. The question by the judge, there are no defendants either in the civil case nor the criminal case. The judge asks the questions, examines the witnesses.
Excuse me, Robert. So in the first case, makes a very important point. Maybe some people want to still see the movie.
I do the same thing. Please don't give up your movie.
Okay, so call it Film X.
I've seen the movie, so I'm happy.
So in the civil case, the judge listens to both parties and he asks a couple of questions. He says, you know what? This is trivial. Go home and work it out between yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting in a sense because there's no clear-cut way of deciding a matter. Like he could arbitrarily decide for one party or the other, but he'll work it out. In the criminal case, it's a hullabaloo. Wrong party and the defendant is in jail.
I don't have to go see the judge.
Take it easy. Let me ask you a few questions. And they adjourn and they bring back witnesses. The judge has some issues with some of the witnesses. I need some cooperation. So it goes on. In the meantime,
It's not just that you're going to give away the movie. It's like you're going to run away with the class here unless we reach a conclusion soon.
The family of the defendant and the family of the home party are trying to work out a financial settlement, which if they do, the criminal case will occur. So I think it was very illuminating for the kinds of things we are settling here, both the procedure and the means of arriving at a resolution of the case. similar. It's sort of like somebody would have taken this receptor and sort of acted out this mission for it.
Right.
So it's worth seeing the film.
Okay. If you only see one film this year. Okay. Okay. No. I'm sorry. I know. No, I understand that it's serious. So one of the things that you said actually echoes something that the rabbi said, which is that there are cases where the court will not take a case because of ziluta de beit dina. It's seen as degrading the court. That the question is so trivial that it is disrespect for the court to take its time to decide that issue. So the first case that you mentioned, where the judge said, you know, go home, work it out yourselves, you know, I don't know exactly what he meant by that, but maybe that's part of what he was saying. He was saying, this is something that you should be able to work out by yourself. You shouldn't have to involve outside parties to get it resolved. And in doing so, you're asking us to do something that really is, you know, beneath our dignity, and also perhaps makes things greater than they are. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to offend you. I apologize.
I'm not going to like that. I'm just seeing it as his decision would have to be arbitrary because there were no fundamental issues on the disagreement.
I think he
could be forced to make a decision, but it's much better if they work it out.
Right, but there is that notion that certain things shouldn't be brought to court. Or, for example, when a court will decide, like, a libel case. But it's totally trivial. And they'll award damages of $1 to the person. They say, you win, and you get $1. That's the court's way of saying, yeah, okay, but you know what? You guys really should have worked it out yourselves. Yeah.
I have seen the movie. I'm not going to give it away, but he did say it was a divorce case. And that's what's remarkable, and that's one of the things which has been unstated here. Which is, in this situation, we're seeing a woman's voice having as much believability, credibility to the judge as the male voice. And we've had no discussion of that so far in our conversation in the Talmud.
Well, I mean, along similar lines, at the risk of giving away, you know, future statements of the Talmud, there, when it comes to monetary matters, women are believed if everyone agrees that they are reliable witnesses to the case, then they are believed to the same degree that men are. In criminal cases, no. But, yeah.
I think I have problems with statement that an arbitration is as good as a law decision, whether the parties agree to it or they don't agree to it. Okay? Mainly because it seems to me, that there is something about a law, a judicial decision, okay, that's more important, for society and maybe even for the individuals, okay. Than everybody going home feeling, half good, about a case. I mean, I was involved in a dispute. I went to a pretrial conference, and both parties got before a judge. He said, well, look, why don't we, I'll sit this out. They'll keep going to talk to both sides separately. And I was the first by attorney, and I spoke to her first. And she said, Mr. Lowenthal, what are you seeking here? And I said, well, I'm seeking justice. She said, well, you came to the wrong place. And as simple as that. And the point of fact is, I felt that we have a law, we have a court, and this is what we're paying these people for. And I think that the same thing, that here you're talking about the law of God. Rabbis, it's not the law of New York State, rabbis have to decide the case on, I would think that they think real carefully before they decide to, you know, let some two clowns decide what the act is, okay, you know, rather than what God thought the right decision should be in this case.
Well, I suspect that the response of the rabbis who favor arbitration would say that this is also God's law. Right? It is God's law or God's will that people live in harmony. And so, what constitutes justice? It's like, I mean, another instance that is not exactly the same as what we're talking about here, but is similar, is law and equity. Right? What is just? So if you follow the canons of law, then it could be that in certain circumstances, according to the letter of the law, I have to pay you X amount of money. According to equity, because of different factors, I'm not a very learned individual, I didn't read the contract, and it would have been very difficult for me to read the contract, I'm not well off, the other person is very well off. Right? So it may be that from a legal point of view, I should have to pay. But from the point of view of equity, of what's fair, whatever that means, it's a problematic term. But let's say for now what we feel instinctively would be the right or the best solution, that is a different solution. So to say that the letter of the law is just is not untrue, but it's not absolutely true. It's not true or exclusively true. It's not true to the exclusion of other kinds of justice or fairness. That's what I would say. I mean, as to the statement that this person made, I mean, I think that has more to do with the way courts function and how many cases are on the docket and all of that. So, I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly what they meant by you're not going to get justice. Yeah.
One thing I think that is also being ignored a bit here is in cases judged strictly by law, there are standards of evidence that are defined. And it could be that, you know, according to the facts of what happened, you know, party A is supposed to be compensated. But because they don't have enough or witnesses or witnesses, the witnesses that they have had some sort of legal defect in them.
Mm-hmm.
If you judged it by strict law, party A wouldn't be compensated.
Right.
And
fair enough.
In that sort of case, which is justice, party A not getting compensated because, you know, they can't prove to the legal standards, or party A getting compensated because the facts of what damages actually happened cause it.
Right. Good point. Very good point. So,
Well, I just would like to point out that it's very easy to say claim justice, but we're living in a human world, and oftentimes you can't come to it. Two people can disagree about what a just solution is, but let's say in a murder case, what justice is there? You can't bring the person back, or let's say the case where maybe somebody breaks some heirloom. You know, it's a priceless heirloom. There's no human way to decide what is a just solution. So a compromise could be just as good as in a just sense as what would be decided by a judge.
And you're raising a whole other problem, which is that law can't fix everything. Okay, so where are we? Somewhere here. Okay, so we are now on the top of the right-hand column. Yes, the Gemara returns to a verse discussed in the Braita, Uvotzea Beirech Ni'etz Hashem, which was taken to mean one who praises a compromiser insults God. Okay? So, that was cited by Rabbi Eliezer, who took the position that it is forbidden to solve a case based on arbitration, based on compromise. So he, that Tana, disagrees with Rabbi Tanchum bar Kanilai, who is a post-Mishnaic rabbi, but he is from Eretz Yisrael. You've discussed how you know a rabbi is Babylonian or from Eretz Yisrael. We discussed that. Yeah, okay, good. What?
Rabbi, I think, is Israel.
Right. Is Babel. Exactly right. So this is a rabbi from Eretz Yisrael. This verse was stated only in reference to the episode of the golden calf. As it is stated, and Aaron saw and built an altar before it, before the calf. So the Torah doesn't tell us what is it that Aaron saw that motivated him to build an altar for the gold calf, which of course is a very surprising, to say the least, action on the part of Aaron. So the Talmud explains, Aaron's decision to build the golden calf was based on compromise. How so? What did Aaron see? Rabbi Binyamin bar Yefet said in the name of Rabbi Elazar, Aaron saw Hur slaughtered before him. Now, if you recall, at the end of Parshat Mishpatim, as Moses is about to ascend the mountain together with Joshua, he says to the elders, you know, if you have any questions, well, Aharon and Hur are here, and you can, you know, Mibal Devarim Yigash Aleichem. Anyone who has some issue can go talk to you. By the time that we get to the sin of the golden calf, and Moses is still up on the mountain, right, we hear about Aaron, but we don't hear about Hur. So the rabbis characteristically say, well, if Hur isn't mentioned, then something happened. What happened? The rabbis suggest that what happened is Hur was killed. He was murdered by the mob. He was murdered by the mob because he stood up to the mob and said, we can't have a golden calf, that's idolatry. And the mob said, okay, well, then we're going to kill you. And they did. So that's what Aaron saw. So, and so he said to himself, if I do not listen to them now, they will do to me as they did to Hur, and they will fulfill the following verse through me. Should a priest and prophet be slain in the sanctuary of God? Now, okay, this is a little bit complicated. Very often, Agadah is actually more complicated than Halakha in the Talmud, particularly because of the allusions. So there is a verse in the second book of Chronicles that says that during the reign of Yehoash, which was the beginning of the 8th century BCE, he was one of the kings of Judah, the people started going back to forms of idolatrous worship. And the Zechariah ben Berechia, who was a prophet and also a priest, stood up and said, you may not do this. This is wrong. And the people killed him in the precincts of the temple itself. That's what is reported there. And so what the rabbis are saying is that when this verse, and this verse is from Lamentations, and according to the simple meaning of the verse, this is a complaint against God. Right? Why should it be God that in the midst of this destruction, a prophet and priest should be killed? But according to rabbinic interpretation, these words are a divine response to the people. If you want to know why the destruction came about, here's one of the reasons. Because you allowed a priest and a prophet to be killed, namely Zechariah ben Berechia. And if you look at note number 9, you'll see that he cites a very strange passage. The temple was destroyed in retribution for the murder of Zechariah. Although Zechariah was, I mean, that's hard to buy, but let's say it was a factor, you could say, theologically. Although Zechariah was killed many years before the destruction, it is possible that the decree to destroy the temple was made at that time. The fate of the temple was sealed. The Gemara below states that Zechariah's blood bubbled on the ground, and did not rest until the time of the temple's destruction, when the Nebuzaradan, claiming to be avenging Zechariah's murder, slaughtered 940,000 Jews. He comes, according to this legend, Nebuzaradan comes into the temples, the Babylonian general comes into the temple and he sees this bubbling blood. And he says to them, what's this about? And the people dissemble, they don't want to tell him, and he starts slaughtering children. It's a horrible story, but anyway, in the end, finally, blood stops bubbling. When I don't remember who it is, says to the blood, what do you want? You know, we're all going to be slaughtered. It's enough already. So the blood stops bubbling. Okay. This is a very right.
The Japanese tales are all the same.
Yeah. Well, think of Poe's Telltale Heart, right? Similar idea. Okay. Good. So he said to himself, I don't want the people to be guilty of killing a priest and prophet in the sanctuary of Hashem. What is interesting to me, and there are many instances of that, is frankly, if I were there and I were Aaron and I saw Hur being slain, I would probably say to myself, it's probably not a good idea to do what Hur did because I'll be killed. But Aaron is presented as saying, in effect, I'm not giving in out of fear for my own life, but because I do not want to become an instrument of the people sinning. If they kill me, they will have done this terrible deed, and I don't want them to be guilty of this terrible deed.
And never forget.
So if they do this, then there will never be a remedy for them. They can never be forgiven. It is better that they make a golden calf, and it is possible that there will be a remedy for them through repentance. Right? Because obviously murder is a crime that cannot be undone in any significant way. Idolatry is not a good thing, but it doesn't change the world and doesn't affect humanity in any irreversible way. And so, and also, by the way, another point here is idolatry is a sin against God. Right, murder is a sin not only against God but against a fellow human being. In general, the rabbis demand more compassion of God than they, or expect more compassion of God than they expect from fellow human beings. This is one of the characteristics of God, that God is more compassionate.
But Aaron wasn't in the sanctuary with Hashem.
Yeah. Okay. Look, Aaron is quoting a verse from the Lamentations, right, going to this. Okay, this is, again, classic rabbinic interpretation. The history is collapsed, and all of the of Tanakh can comment, one book can comment on the other, even though they're written at different times. This is standard operating procedure. Neimuk damu chara Torah, right.
In the Torah itself, is there one good thing that Aaron ever did in the five books of Moses?
Yeah.
Did he ever do anything good?
Anything like?
Well, anything that makes him so noble.
Let's go to Aaron.
Well, first of all, he served as an emissary speaking to Pharaoh. I would also say, you know what I would say is the greatest thing, actually? If you remember, God says that when you return, he says to Moses, that when you return to Egypt, your brother Aaron, elder brother, remember, Aaron, will see you and he will rejoice. Now, if I were Moses' elder brother and Moses returned to tell me that he had been appointed to be the one to take the Israelites out of Egypt, I'm not sure that I would have reacted with great joy. I think I probably would have reacted with envy, with jealousy, with anger. I'm the older brother. Why shouldn't I have been chosen? So in some ways, to my way of thinking, that was one of the greatest things that Aaron did. He did something that I think is very difficult for human beings to do, which is to be genuinely happy when someone attains something that we ourselves would have wanted to attain or perhaps felt in some sense that was coming to us. I think that's a very difficult thing to do. And then, of course, the rabbis have other explanations, right? He was Ohev Shalom, Rodev Shalom. He made peace. And they do that by extrapolating from the story of the golden calf, right? Because the way they read the story is Aaron is trying to keep the peace, even at the expense of building a golden calf. I often like to say that if you think of Moses and Aaron, you're talking about two extremes, and ideally you want somebody who's in the middle somewhere, right? Moses goes up to the mountain, and remember the Torah tells us that he delayed in returning. The rabbinic midrash says that, so the midrash says that no, he had told them when he was going to come back, but the Israelites miscalculated and they didn't realize that. Okay, very nice. But the simple meaning of the Torah is that somehow Moses is up on that mountain too long. And let's face it, if you were Moses, where would you want to be? With God, you know, in the presence of God's radiance and wisdom, or down with a bunch of squabbling Israelites? I know what I would choose, and I think that Moses made that same choice. So Moses wasn't that anxious to get back to the Israelites. And that's how I read this delaying. You know, well, they'll get there. Just a couple of minutes. Whereas Aaron was so tuned in to the people that he had difficulty rising above them and saying, yes, I understand what you're saying, but, you know, however that sentence would continue. So, you know, each of them sort of was overbalanced in one direction or the other, and there was this tragic divide between the two of them. Okay.
I have some big comments.
Yeah.
It's unrelated to the law, but this situation reminds me of the situation of King Saul and Shmuel.
Yeah.
Shmuel was supposed to come and give his blessings and make a korban, and he, Moshe Shlomo, he took his time, and Saul didn't know what was happening, so he decided to make the korban himself. And then Samuel Shmuel shows up and is very angry. So maybe it's a certain tactics, deliberate, like, that, you know, challenge your trust in some way.
Okay, but it's a tactic, or it's a foreshadowing of the fact that Saul is not the best candidate for king. And so, you know, Shmuel thinks this or intuits this, and so he's not rushing to show up. Okay, let's get back to the business at hand. Okay, so those Tanaim, so we're back at the top of the page, those Tanaim who do not subscribe to Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh's verse, right? Their opinion. How do they expound the verse, releasing water is the beginning of strife? Okay, so what is going on here? So first of all, just methodologically what's going on is that when Rabbi A tries to prove his position by quoting a particular verse, if Rabbi B disagrees, the Talmud assumes that it's not enough for him to say, I disagree with you from a logical perspective or from a ideological perspective. He has to be able to take that same verse, which is quoted as a proof text by Rabbi A, and neutralize that verse. And the way you neutralize that verse is by giving it a different interpretation so that it no longer supports Rabbi A. So the verse in question is this verse in Hebrew, Poter Maim Reshit Madon, which is translated in a variety of ways. Rabbi Shimon ben Menasseh said that once you know which way the law is leaning, you may not call for compromise. And he quotes this verse of Poter Maim Reshit Madon Lifnei Hitgala Harif Nitosh, by which he means to say that before the argument is revealed, Lifnei Hitgala Harif, before the argument is revealed, then Nitosh, then you can move away from law and go to arbitration. But once you know which way the law is going, you may not walk away from the law. So they expound the verse in accordance with Rav Hamnuna's interpretation, for Rav Hamnuna said, the beginning of a person's judgment in the world to come concerns only matters of Torah, as it is stated, releasing water is the beginning of judgment. In other words, Poter Mayim is being interpreted in the original verse, just so we know what the verse actually means in its simplest meaning, right? It means that Reshit Madon, okay, the beginning of a disagreement, of a fight between two people, is Poter Mayim. It's like opening the floodgates, right? Once you start disagreeing with somebody, once a fight starts, you can escalate, get way out of hand. But the rabbis are not interpreting the verse that way. So how is it being interpreted here? Poter Mayim, poter from patur, exempt. Somehow, if I exempt myself from Mayim, from water, and water is metaphorically Torah, right? It is the source of life. This is the beginning of Reshit of Madon, as in judgment. So I'm first judged for having set aside Torah. That's how the verse is being interpreted according to Rav Hamnuna. In which case, this verse has nothing to do with whether compromise is a good thing or a bad thing. It's talking about something else altogether. Another explanation of this verse, Rav Huna said, discord is comparable to a channel formed by a gush of water from an overflowing river. And which actually I think is pretty much the simple meaning of the verse, as I said to you before. Once the channel widens, it will certainly continue to widen. So the verse is expounded thus, the opening of a channel of water is an analogy for the beginning of discord, which I think actually is what the verse means. Another metaphor for the development of discord, Abaye Kashisha, Kashisha is the elder. Have you ever heard of Yad L'Kashish in Israel, an organization that helps the elderly? Abaye Kashisha said, discord is to be compared to a plank in a new bridge. Once it becomes firm, it remains firm. Right? It's hard to pull up the plank once it is built into the bridge. And I would say that this teaching and the previous teaching refer to two negative effects of quarrels that arise between people. One is, as said in the previous view, that it escalates. Right? Once people start to fight, they get angrier and angrier. They can pull other people into it. It can become horrible. It can escalate, you know, geometrically. But the second thing that's often true about a fight is that once you've had a fight with someone, it's often very difficult to restore your relationship with that person to what it was before you had the fight. Right? Which is, you know, this idea that a disagreement is like a plank. It's there, it's always between you, and it's very, very hard to take it away. It's very, very hard to act as though it never occurred. And, you know, besides being nice metaphors and ingenious interpretations of the verses. You know, when I was a kid and I learned things like this in the Talmud, first of all, I didn't know a whole lot about life. So I wasn't really in a position to appreciate the significance of what was being said here. But in general, I viewed these things as clever, interesting. The more I've lived, the more I realized that this is actually very good advice. And I try to read it as, you know, not just brilliant or not brilliant interpretation, but as really focusing me on things that I tend to take for granted. You know, and this is a perfect example of that. like, we can all read about the fact, we all know, right, that it's bad to have a quarrel with somebody. We all know that. But the real question is, when the rubber hits the road, when the opportunity arises, or the possibility arises, of my having a disagreement with somebody, what do I do? That's a much more difficult question. Do I say, yeah, I know it's bad to have a quarrel, but in this case, you know, he's really wrong. Or do I say, no, that's exactly the point of the Talmud. It's precisely in cases like this one, where I know that that other person is wrong, that if I take seriously what's being said here, I should still seek to find a way to disagree, to step back from the argument. I mean, I don't know, I feel like I'm being, you know, giving marriage advice here, but I'll say this anyway. I know in my own experience, and I've heard this from many friends, that this is particularly true in a marriage, which is that some people in a marriage want to be right. Right? If you have some disagreement with your spouse, and you're right, and the other person is wrong, you have to, you know, hold out to the bitter end to show that you are right. Okay? That often does not end well. And I think, you know, some of the advice that's being given here is, you know what? Maybe you are right. So what? So what? Is that more important to you? As somebody once said to me, do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? Right. Okay. But the point is, it takes hard work. Right? It's very hard. When I'm right, and it bothers me that somebody should say something else. That's why the rabbis say in Pirkei Avot, right? Ezeu hagibor hakoveshet Yisro. Right? The person who is really mighty is the person who is able to restrain his or her impulses. And again, in my personal experience, that is the act that takes more might than anything else in my life, to know when to zip it.
I wonder if we should tell that to the Iranians.
So be my guest. I don't think it's going to...
Saying this could really be syndicated like in a newspaper column and call it Dear Abaye.
Whoa! Okay. How long were you waiting to spring?
Now, one thing is Rabbi Wexler, I mean, this is actually apropos of what you just said, about his, you know, the part of his work where he counsels couples. And he said that it's very simple. He said usually the husband wants to go to the ocean and the wife wants to go to the mountains. And the husband comes to him and says, well, what should I do? He says, well, you should compromise. Go to the mountains.
There you go. All right. Makes sense to me. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I think we'll stop here. Okay, with this discussion. Yes, the Gemara records another interpretation of the verse, Koter Mayim, releasing water. This teaching is the first of a series of teachings that follow the same pattern. They are introduced with a mnemonic. So the Hebrew letters that appear immediately after this paragraph were a way. Remember that Talmud was taught, it was transmitted and studied orally, well into the 9th and even 10th century. So that means that you had to memorize large chunks of the Talmud. How did you do that? Well, there were a variety of techniques in the ancient world for memorizing. People had an incredible ability to memorize, much more so than we do, because we just don't need to. Right? I just fire up my computer. So these were mnemonic devices that helped people remember when there was a series of stories or a series of sayings, to remember what they were and in what order they appeared. So, here's the first story that we have. There was this man who walked along saying, fortunate is one who hears his own denigration without responding and becomes accustomed to this. Through his silence, 100 misfortunes that would have befallen him as a result of the dispute pass him by. Okay? So that is sort of a folk saying. Okay? And Samuel, Shmuel, said to Rabbi Judah, Rabbi Yehuda, this is written in a verse. Releasing water is the beginning of strife, which on a homiletical level teaches that discord is the beginning of 100 misfortunes. Now, where you get the 100 in here is not clear. Some say that it has to do, take a look at in the notes on the top of the right-hand column, the second line, Madon, which is the word that is means strife, is taken as an abbreviation of Me'adine, 100 misfortunes. Or else, in Gematria, it adds up to 100. Okay, good. What's interesting about this is that this is a trope that appears very often in rabbinic literature, which is that someone spouts a piece of folk wisdom and the rabbis say, you know what? That piece of folk wisdom is actually in the Torah itself. Now, the question is, what's going on here? Why is it important for a rabbi to say that this piece of folk wisdom can also be found in a pasuk, also be found in a verse? Because I, for one, don't believe that this is said without having some agenda. I believe there is an agenda. One possibility is that in a number of places in rabbinic Agadah, the point is made in one way or another that all wisdom can be found somewhere in the Torah. Okay? For example, if you remember the story of Yochanan ben Zakkai when he smuggled out of Jerusalem so that he can make some kind of come to terms, right, with Vespasian. So he tells Vespasian, he greets him as emperor, but Vespasian is not yet the emperor, so he says, why are you greeting me as emperor? So he tells him, because I know that the only person who could possibly conquer Jerusalem is someone who is an emperor. And he proves it to him from a verse. But then at a certain point, someone comes and tells Vespasian that indeed he has become the Caesar, and he then tries to put on his shoe, and he's unable to put on his shoe. And he doesn't understand why. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai says, well, there's a verse that explains this. Shmua tova tedashen deshen, etc. That a hearing good news causes the bones to expand. Okay, that's obviously has another meaning, but that could be taken as its literal meaning. And then he says to him, so what should I do to be able to put on the shoes? So he says, have somebody you don't like pass before you. That will cause the swelling to go down. Now, what is the point of that? Again, I would argue that the point of that is to show that this man, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, doesn't only know, you know, when Shabbat starts and what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, and what happens if your ox gores somebody else or someone else's ox. This is a person who understands all aspects of life. And how so? Through the Torah. You know how to read the Torah properly, there's nothing in life that can't be addressed through this wisdom. So to me, that seems to be one of the reasons that the rabbis do this, is to say, that's a great piece of wisdom, and guess what? If you really know the Torah, you already know that piece of wisdom. Okay. Next story. There was this man who walked along saying, for 2 and 3 thefts, a thief is not killed. And if you look at note 17, one interpretation of that is to say, if a person commits 2 or 3 sins and is not punished, he should not be surprised. A thief might not be killed even after 2 or 3 thefts, but to be sure, he will be punished eventually. I mean, this reminds me, I know people who did the ham sandwich on Yom Kippur test. Right? You have the ham sandwich on Yom Kippur, and you see whether or not you're struck down by lightning, and you're not, and so that shows that the Torah is, the whole thing is a hoax. Right? Well, that's based on a very, what I would call, primitive understanding of what Torah and religious life is all about. But here, the problem is basically a problem of justice, right? If crime does not pay, if sin, you know, if sin and crime are punished by God, how is it that we have all of these people walking around who are thieving and who seem to be doing just fine? And the answer that's being given here is, don't worry. You know, the wheels grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly small. Eventually, it will happen. Eventually, this person will meet the fate that he deserves. So that's the point that's being made. And of course, that is supposed to help us deal with the fact that we live in an apparently unjust world. And the claim that's being made here is, in the end, it is a just world. Okay, that's the claim. I think it's all right. So Shmuel said to Rav Yehuda, "This is written in a verse. Thus says Hashem, regarding the three sins of Israel, I will grant pardon, but regarding a fourth, I will not turn away from punishing him." And this comes from the prophet Amos, and he then lists the sins that Israel has committed, and says that this is a fourth sin for which they will not be forgiven. So you see that God has sort of given Israel a bye for three sins, but once the fourth happens, they're not going to be forgiven. Notice also the structure of the Talmud here. That is, the structure you have here is sort of, let me say it right. A, B, B, C, C, D. It's a sort of a chain connection. What do I mean by that? Prior to our getting into these folk sayings, we had a verse, Poter Mayim Reshit Madom, which was being interpreted in connection with compromise. At the end of that section, the Talmud says, well, if you don't think this verse has to do with compromise, it's not a statement about compromise, then it has to have to do with something else. So the Talmud says, okay, yes, it does have to do with something else. And we're going to tell you what that something else is. And now the Talmud says, well, since we're offering interpretations for this verse, we're going to tell you a story about a man who came along with a folk saying, and a rabbi said that this folk saying is embodied in this verse that we've been discussing. And now, since we've told you a story about someone who came along with a folk saying and was found in a verse, now we're going to tell you other stories of people who came along with folk sayings and their wisdom was found in a verse, right? So you have discussion of compromise, which talks about a particular verse that has different interpretations. Once we're talking about interpretations of that verse, we come to part B, which is a story of somebody who has a folk saying, which is found in that verse. Once we're talking about folk sayings, we come to part C, which is about folk sayings which are found in verses. So you can see how the Talmudic structure works. Okay. There was this man who walked along saying, even if seven pits are dug in the path of a man of peace, he will be saved from them all. But if just one pit is dug in the path of an evildoer, he will fall into it. Now, by the way, needless to say, these sayings lose in the translation. And what I mean by that is, let's take this saying. So in the original it is, Shav Beiri L'Shalmana V'Chada L'Avid Bish. Right? So it's a sentence with six words. Three words describing what happens to the person of peace, three words describing what happens to the evildoer. And you have the first half starting with the number seven, and the second half starting with the number one. So in the original Aramaic, it's a lot snappier, is my point. And it sounds a lot more like what we think of as, you know, a saying, stitch in time saves nine, or that kind of thing. Okay. So, Shmuel said to Rav Yehuda, this is written in a verse. For seven times a righteous man falls and rises, but a wicked man falls the first time. So sure enough, this very bit of wisdom is found in the verse itself. Let's see. Maybe we'll do a couple more. There was this man who walked along saying, one who leaves a court having had his coat removed, in other words, the court ruled against him, removing his coat as payment to his opponent, should sing a song as he goes on his way. Meaning, he should be happy that wrongly acquired property was removed from his possession. Now, this is how all of the commentators... Yeah, right. This is how the traditional commentators generally understand this verse. I don't think that's what it means at all. Right? What else could it mean? Means it could have been worse, right? And if you go, and if you know the attitude that people had towards the courts of those times, or at least to some of the courts of those times, courts did not always have good reputations. Many of them were considered to be corrupt. The Babylonian Talmud distinguishes between different kinds of courts in Babylonia, some of which it considered to be just and reliable, and others which it considered to be corrupt. So my assumption is that it's in connection with a court of the second kind that this saying arises, which is to say, if all you lost was your coat, count yourself as having come out ahead. Because these guys can take more than your coat. Okay, so Shmuel said to Rabbi Huda, this is written in a verse. And also, all this nation shall arrive at their place in peace. So this is when Yitro is giving advice to Moshe, and he's telling him to set up a judicial system. And he says, if you do this, then all the nation shall arrive at their place in peace, which apparently is being interpreted here in a very minimalist way. That at the very least, people will get home. You know, they may have lost what they lost, but they'll live to litigate another day. Okay, there was this man who walked along saying, when a woman sleeps, the basket perched on her head lowers. In other words, when a person is lazy, the quality of his handiwork suffers. Okay. What do you mean, what does it mean?
When a woman sleeps, the basket is on her head? Is that what you said?
No, the basket is lowered. Okay? If I have a basket on my head and I fall asleep, the basket's going to fall off my head.
But something is lowering.
Yeah, literally it means lower, but I think it means more like falls off her head. I sometimes say to my students when we study certain passages in the Talmud, you had to be there. I mean, there are certain things that you just, especially when it comes to humor and certain kinds of wisdom. You know, if you're not there, you don't quite get the force of what's being said. I mean, the best that I can do with something like this is knowing that people carried things on their head, that this was a common occurrence, and if we imagine that a woman, it doesn't have to be a woman, but okay, a woman who's carrying something on her head gets tired and she lies down, then before you know it, the basket is going to slip off her head and whatever is in it is going to be smashed or whatever it is, like the story about, you know, don't count your chicks before they hatch kind of story. So that's what I imagine the vision is that we're supposed to have. And Shmuel says to Rabbi Huda, well, this is exactly what it says in Ecclesiastes, which is that through slothfulness, bad things happen. The ceiling sags and lists many other things that will happen. Now, it's basically, the basic principle in the world is entropy. And unless human energy is applied to resist that entropy, things are going to fall apart. And they do. Let's take one more. There was this man who walked along saying, The man in whom I trusted raised his fist and stood against me. Rav Shmuel said to Rav Yehuda, this is written in a verse, even my ally whom I trusted has raised his heel against me. And this comes from a psalm, and very often in psalms, one of the themes in psalms is that the psalmist talks about being betrayed by someone else, by a friend or by others. And that one of the reasons that the psalmist is turning to God is that God is the only one upon whom he can rely. You know, I turn to my fellow human beings, I couldn't rely on them. In the psalm that we read as part of the Hallel, it says, "Al tiftechu b'nedivim, b'ven adam she'ein lo teshua." Right? Don't put your faith in princes, don't put your faith in people that, I would say, cannot guarantee victory. Right? They can promise, but they can't necessarily deliver. Let's do one more. This one I like. I don't know if you like it. No, don't worry. It's not a long one. Well, it is a long one. But let's just do the beginning of it. Okay. There was this man who walked along saying, when our love, the love between me and my wife and myself, was strong, we could have lain together on the width of a sword. But now that our love is not strong, a bed with a width of 60 amot does not suffice for us. And we won't go through it, but Rav Huna goes on in a rather complex way to show that, yes, this too is in the Torah. I just like that. It's just another piece of wisdom that I find helpful. I mean, I guess what I take away from that saying is that very often we misattribute the causes of our unhappiness or misfortune. We think that if I, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they call it the geographical cure. Right? I live in New York and my drinking is uncontrollable. So I say to myself, I'm going to move to San Francisco because I think things will go better there. The only problem is that I forgot that when I moved to San Francisco, I'm bringing myself with me. And so it is highly unlikely that moving to San Francisco is going to help me address my drinking problem in a more effective way. And in terms of our own life, when we experience unhappiness or frustration, we sometimes misidentify what the origin of that unhappiness and frustration is. And often enough, the origin of that unhappiness and frustration is in here. And yet we identify the source of it as being somewhere else. And that, in effect, is what I understand this story to be saying. That, if you find a way of getting along with your spouse or with your friend, even if the external conditions are not that great, you can still experience happiness. On the other hand, if the relationship itself isn't working, then, getting a bigger house or having a child or, going back to school or, whatever it is, it's not going to do it. So this, again, I find a very important piece of advice. So, I know I'm sort of doing a commercial here for Talmud, but I admit it up front and then I do it, which is to say that on the one hand, the Talmud is a very exotic document. In some ways, it's very foreign to a contemporary way of thinking. But in its own very often, random and disorganized way, at least not organized in the way that we are used to having information organized, there is much to chew on, and there is much to think about. And how much wisdom we take away from the Talmud depends to a great extent on how thoughtfully we read the Talmud and how open we are to imagining that it might have something to say to us. In Zen Buddhism they say, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And the Talmud can be a great teacher, I believe. I mean, there are passages in the Talmud that I would call, I sometimes use the term, unredeemable. Things that are said that I just can't, for myself, really think as legitimate parts of Torah. But on the other hand, there's a lot of great wisdom and intensive reading of the Talmud and a willingness to sort of put ourselves into it. We can walk away with a lot of wisdom.
Thank you.